Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He is professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. He's a lecturer at George Washington University, and he is former chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell. And he will be speaking in a lecture titled, Why a Dramatic Change in U.S.-Cuba Policy is More Important Than Ever, this Saturday, November 13th at 4 o'clock at the Forum at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.
So after the Cuban Revolution that established what is still the current Cuban government in 1959, there was a long period of relations between the U.S. and Cuba that reflected Cold War politics, including a decades-long embargo. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, what were the reasons for maintaining those relations and that embargo against Cuba?
That's an excellent question. I can only tell you that it's my best estimate that the reasons are domestic and not international, not foreign policy, not national security. Once the Soviet Union had collapsed, Cuba and the 11.5 million people on the island of Cuba, more importantly, went through a very traumatic period. The withdrawal of subsidies by the Soviet Union even impacted the incidence of disease on the island. It brought back, for example, diseases that had been eradicated. It impacted the caloric intake, that is, the amount of calories that people actually got from food or food that they didn't eat. People lost weight. Sometimes a 160-pound gentleman, for example, would go to 120 pounds. It was a truly traumatic time period for them. And what the Cuban leadership did at that time, in my estimation, is they decided that if they got through this, and they weren't at all sure they were going to get through it, if they got through it, they would never attach their country to a single entity like the Soviet Union again. They would diversify, in other words. Not only would they diversify their economic posture, their agriculture, their industry, and so forth, but they would diversify those with whom they did any kind of business, and any kind of business in the way of getting foreign aid or getting major amounts of, shall we say, subsidized product from, like they now get a lot of heavy fuel oil from Venezuela on a very subsidized basis. That is to say, it's very cheap. So the answer to your question is that Cuba changed majorly after the end of the Cold War, and we kept the very same policies intact, the most prominent of which is the almost total embargo on Cuba that we've had in place ever since 1960.
There is a... Basically, the common wisdom on that is that it has to do with the fact that Florida is a swing state during presidential elections, and everybody is trying to gain the favor of Miami voters who can truly swing presidential elections and have done so, and they tend to vote for people who have a hardline stance against Cuba. Does it really boil down to that?
I think it does, and particularly for the administration which I serve, which was the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney administration, and I should throw Karl Rove in there, too, because the reason the George Bush administration came in and made things even more draconian with regard to the island was because they felt like they owed the 27 electoral votes in Florida, after all, ultimately, with the Supreme Court decision through the election to George W. Bush, they owed their position in the White House to those Cuban voters in Florida, and so it was their payback to them, so to speak, that they tighten up even further the embargo and the restrictions on Cuba, and they proceeded to do that. I think it's less so now, and in fact, President Obama was the first person elected to the Oval Office who actually did not need the Cuban-American vote to swing the 27 electoral votes in Florida. So it's been a mystery to me why the Obama administration has not moved more swiftly to at least return to the Clinton administration attitude with respect to Cuba, and really to go well beyond that, to begin a process of normalizing relations with this country. Because Clearly, the Cuban-American influence, at least in terms of the electoral votes, has fallen off. Now, let me hasten to add, it has not fallen off in terms of political action committee money donations and in terms of people like Ileana Ross-Layton and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Menendez in the Senate and others, and soon to be Marco Rubio in the Senate. Their willingness to play hardball with anyone who is going to vote against their policies. And the situation is such that Cuba's not high on any congressman or senator's agenda. And so if there are other issues that are, and there always are, and Debbie and Ileana and the other members of the Congress promise to be with them on those issues, then it's real easy for them to get that particular individual with them on the Cuba issue, because the Cuba issue normally doesn't matter. It's too far down the totem pole of priorities, if you will, to matter. So they use political pressure, they use that kind of pressure, they use money, and they continue to have a stranglehold on U.S.-Cuba policy.
Cuba is one of many Latin American nations, and I was wondering how U.S. policy towards Cuba compares to other Latin American nations in terms of U.S. policy.
That's a good question, and I would take it in a different. I'll try to answer your question, but I'll take it in a different direction initially, at least. I think one of the reasons that we need better relations with Cuba is Latin America, is our own hemisphere. We don't seem to have a policy with respect to the Western Hemisphere other than buying oil from Canada, oil from Mexico, oil from Venezuela, chastising Chavez in Venezuela from time to time, and essentially maintaining the embargo on Cuba. We need a whole lot better policy. We need a better strategy with regard to how we deal with our own hemisphere. We've just had a president serve in Brazil, Lula, who was about 81-82% in the polls after 8 years in office. That is unprecedented. This was an extremely popular leader who did a lot for Brazil. If Brazil can get sustained leadership like that for another term or two, then Brazil is going to be a country to be reckoned with. It is already being reckoned with in South America and elsewhere. The Chinese are afoot in South America in a very major way, making contracts, economic contracts, making resource contracts, and so forth. Latin America is a place that we ignore at our peril, and one of the impediments to having a good policy with respect to Latin America is our embargo on Cuba. For example, in the UN General Assembly, every time the vote comes up, it's about 184-3. That is to say, 184 nations vote against us. Israel, us, and maybe the Marshall Islands or Palau vote for it. That's an absurdity. The embargo is unpopular with everyone in the world, virtually, but certainly in Latin America, and it impairs our ability to have better relations with other countries in Latin America. So one of the first things I would do is one of the first things I'd say with regard to normalizing relations with Cuba is it will open the door to a far more positive and a better policy, ultimately more successful economically, financially, politically, democracy-wise, with the whole of Latin America. To directly answer your question, and to put it bluntly, I don't think we have that good of relations with almost any country in South America or Central America now. And I would even say we don't have that good of relations with Mexico, because essentially what we're doing with Mexico is taking drugs that are causing Mexico to have an extraordinary problem with crime, with money laundering, with drug lords, with weapons being used against their police and their military and so forth. And the real center of gravity of that struggle is not Mexican incompetence, as it is so often portrayed. It's the fact that the United States has made those drugs illicit and is sucking those drugs down, as it were. In other words, the way to go after that problem is not to fight it with bombs, bullets, and bayonets, nor to force the Mexicans to do that. It's to fight the drug consumption in this country, and in some cases possibly even legalize certain of the drugs that aren't quite as heinous as others. We have, with the drug war, we have globalized prohibition. If you're familiar with what happened after Prohibition or during Prohibition in this country when we outlawed alcohol and the consumption thereof, and we created organized crime within the United States, that's what gave it its great impetus. We've done the same thing globally now with our extraordinary appetite for drugs and our willingness to pay for them. So the real center of gravity of the struggle over drugs is the consumption in this country and in Europe, and not necessarily the people who are producing it.
We're talking to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is going to be giving a talk on Saturday about why change in U.S.-Cuba policy is more important than ever. I think one of the problems that I remember, which is the legacy of the Cold War and U.S. policy under Reagan in the 1980s, was that the U.S. took a very hard line against anything that remotely smacked of communist or socialist or even collectivist ideas, and was training torturers and bombing health centers and blowing up school buses and things like that. And the legacy of that is something that's not forgotten and doesn't make Latin American people, Central or South American, feel very warm toward the United States.
No, and you're right. And we had the same problem, of course, in 54 in Guatemala. We had the problem throughout the late 60s and then the 70s in Chile, when we probably spent a number of taxpayer dollars to try and influence the elections in Chile, and got Rene Schneider, the head of the armed forces, who refused to be anything but a Democrat in Chile, got him assassinated, and then eventually it probably had something to do with Allende, the president of Chile's death. So, yeah, our machinations, our covert operations, our dealings in Latin America in general have not endeared us to a lot of people in Latin America, and we're seeing some of the reaction to that right now, as across South America and elsewhere, people are coming to office who don't necessarily have the traditional attitude about El Coloso del Norte, the United States. In other words, they want to be more independent from the United States. They want to deal with foreign policy issues and so forth from the perspective of Buenos Aires and Brasilia and Lima, and not from the perspective of Washington. So the world is changing. Our power is declining somewhat. Others' power is rising in comparison to it. And there needs to be a reevaluation of the way we approach the rest of the world, and particularly, and we ignore our backyard all the time, but particularly our backyard, which is the Western Hemisphere, our relations with Latin America, Central America, Mexico, and ultimately, too, our relations with Canada. There needs to be a reexamination of that, and we need to begin to pursue foreign policies, economic and financial policies, that are more conducive to what they want to do in their countries in terms of bettering the life and the standard of living of their people. We need to help them to do that, not impede them from doing it. And I think ultimately it's going to be beneficial for us to do that too. And we need to stay in the game of trade and commerce and so forth. And you're not going to be able to do that by force majeure, by compelling them to do your way anymore. So we need to get a little bit more exquisite, a little bit more sophisticated about how we engage with, deal with, collaborate with, cooperate with the rest of the world, and we need to start in our own hemisphere.
One can't help but notice that Cuba is the only one of the nations you've mentioned that has successfully stood up to the United States as long as it has, which
yes.
has to be annoying to the political element that believes that the U.S. should be able to control whoever it wants to through economic and military power.
Unquestionably. I mean, let's face it. Last count, I think, the Castro brothers, Raul and Fidel, had survived 10 American presidents, each one of which had at one time or another been intent on getting rid of them. That ought to tell you something about the flawed nature of our policy. But I'm more concerned. The Castros will go. Fidel will go soon. Raul will follow him. They're over 70. It's the Cuban people I'm concerned about, a wonderful people, a people full of art, music, Shakespeare, dance, you name it. A people who want to do better, who want to have a higher standard of living, but do not want to sacrifice the things that the revolution, so to speak, has gained for them. Things like universal health care, things like a literacy rate of 99%. There are hardly any country in the world that can boast that. They are now, their public diplomacy now consists of sending doctors to places. They have a very robust contingent in Haiti right now, and my friends in Oslo and Norway have just given them some $800,000 to help fund that effort, because, you know, they can't get it from the United States, 90 miles across the Florida Strait. So they're doing all kinds of things in the world now. They're in sub-Saharan Africa. They're in the barrios of Venezuela. They're in South America, Central America with doctors and medical technicians. And that's really effective public diplomacy, and I think it's genuinely reflective of what the Cuban people want to be doing in the world. And so it's a changed world, and the only ones vis-a-vis Cuba that haven't changed are the United States of America.
With all the things that you're describing, that, you know, Cuba has a better literacy rate, child mortality rate, a lot of other indicators than most counties here in New Mexico. Still, they are a debtor nation. Their imports are greater than their exports by a significant margin. How much of their economic problems do you attribute to the U.S. embargo?
I think quite a few, less though perhaps than Raul and Fidel would attribute to it, because they do have pretty robust relations now with most of the rest of the world, including Israel. I encountered Israelis in Havana when I was down there in 2008. So the country that votes with us in the U.N. may vote with us in the U.N., but it's not stupid enough not have people there and not be working with the Cubans. The leadership in Cuba, particularly the younger leadership coming up to replace the Raúls and the Fidels, is very interested in what you just said. It's very interested in raising the standard of living of the Cuban people. And they know that they're going to have to get more market-oriented and more capitalistic, if you will, though they wouldn't use that term, in order to raise those standards of living. And they're doing things now. They just laid off, for example, about 800,000 workers because they didn't need them anymore. But they decided that not just laying them off as the right course of action, but also training them and educating them so they can work in sectors where they do need workers, like the tourism sector, for example, which is growing for them and would grow even more if we lifted the embargo, or even if we just let Americans travel to Cuba, their constitutional right restored, because it's the only country in the world that you as an American citizen can't travel to because your government orders you can't. And isn't that funny? That we claim that Cuba restricts its people from traveling, and here we are restricting our people from traveling to Cuba. You can travel to North Korea, you can travel to China, you can travel to Vietnam, but you can't travel to Cuba, unless you're a Cuban-American, of course, which is a little bit of a tyranny of the majority, or of the minority there, because Cuban-Americans have this distinction so that they're the only Americans who can travel to Cuba. That's kind of silly, and it's another reflection of our failed policy. But the Cubans are trying to change. They're trying to experiment with this, that, and the other thing that we might call free market. They're trying to let farmers sell their food on the private market, for example, and get what the market will bear in terms of prices, and at the same time not make it so overbearing on the Cubans that commodity prices cause them to not be able to buy anything. So it's a complex and difficult thing, but they're trying. And what are we doing to help them? Absolutely nothing.
You mentioned earlier that you were hoping for some significant changes when Obama took office in terms of Cuba policy. What changes have actually happened?
Well, he did restore what George W. Bush had taken away from Cuban Americans. He restored something very important to them, I think, and that was the right for them to travel more frequently. In the past, for example, under George W. Bush, you could have your mother get sick in Cuba, travel to visit her, come home, and she would die in the next 6 months, and you couldn't go back because you could only travel every 2 years or 3 years or something like that. And so that was very onerous burden on the Cuban Americans, and I think it actually backfired on the Bush administration that they did that, but they did it nonetheless. And so what President Obama did was restore their right to travel, and also, very importantly, their right to send remittances to Cuba, in other words, to help their family with buying things like food and shelter and so forth and so on. So money pours into Cuba from these Cuban Americans, mainly to their families and their extended families in places like Santiago and Havana and so forth. And that helped somewhat. He's also talked about telecommunications breakthroughs. There have been talks on things like counter-narcotics operations, counter-drug and counter-terrorist operations and so forth, and those have been fairly successful. But he's not even gone back to the Clinton administration in terms of the liberality of his policies vis-a-vis Cuba. For example, you could have purpose-driven travel to Cuba under President Clinton without so many onerous provisions of having to go through OFAC and the Treasury for a visa and that sort of thing. I understand that the president is sitting on all this and more right now. I think he was unwise to wait for the midterms to unfold. I think he'd have probably done better in the midterms if he had gone ahead and released this package of change. I think, for example, Joe Garcia would have won in Florida, and I think Kindred Meeks was going to lose in Florida anyway. But apparently his strategist couldn't see that. But I think after the midterms now, sometime in the lamed up section, I hope, we get the White House to release this package of changes, which will at least take us back somewhere around the Clinton administration's policies with regard to Cuba. And then we can move there to the next stage and the next stage. But I'm not confident he'll do it because I've not seen a lot of what I would call moral courage on the part of this White House.
You are a career military man. You worked with, you worked under the Bush, as you call it, the Bush-Cheney-Rove administration. You sound like a liberal Democrat. What's changed?
No, I'm just a moderate Republican, which is a vanishing species within my party. We used to have people like Chuck Hagel, Nelson Rockefeller. We used to have people who thought the same way I think, who were more or less conservative on physical issues and conservative on foreign policy, if you will, but were willing to address the fact that everybody isn't wealthy on the social policy side and willing to deal with programs and with people who wanted to help those who weren't wealthy. My Republican Party today has become a party of the wealthy, period. The Democratic Party is not a lot different. That's why we're not seeing a whole lot of change with President Obama. One of my friends said we just exchanged the corporate interest of Texas for the corporate interest of Chicago. I'm a firm believer that right now the real power in this country is corporate power. And we've got to do something about that because that corporate power is going to take us off a cliff if we're not careful. And when I say corporate power, I mean big food, big pharmacy, and big oil. And also finance, insurance, and real estate, which are together responsible largely for this economic and financial crisis we in the world are in right now. So that's a bigger problem, though. Cuba is a subset of that problem. And one of the things that we need to do with regard to Cuba, as I said, is take this draconian policy and throw it in the trash can and begin to treat the 11.5 million Cuban people the way they should be treated, as ultimate friends, as people who live only 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and as people who ought to have the right to increase and enhance their standard of living, to travel when they want to come to the United States if they want to, and we should be able to reciprocate. I don't think that's going to happen overnight, but that should be our ultimate goal, to have, as we do with Vietnam now, with whom we fought a war and lost 58,000 of my buddies in, we need to have better relations, and ultimately we need to have normal relations, as we have with Vietnam, with Cuba.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. He's a lecturer at George Washington University. He was chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he will be speaking here in Santa Fe this weekend, Saturday, November 13th at 4 o'clock at the Forum, which is at the University of Santa Fe, which is at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations and the Santa Fe Holguín Cuba Sister Cities Association. For more information, you can call 505-982-4931. Colonel Wilkerson, we look forward to meeting you.
Thank you, and I look forward to visiting your beautiful state.
Thank you. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program David Tanis. He divides his time between Berkeley, where he is head chef at Chez Panisse, and Paris, where he cooks at home and writes cookbooks. His latest book is Heart of the Artichoke and Other Kitchen Journeys, and he will be here in Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books on Tuesday, the 16th of November at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
This is such an interesting book. We had a person last week talking about a book called The Natural Kitchen. Then I started reading your book, and I'm seeing that people are talking about cooking and being in the kitchen in terms of mindfulness and really slowing down. That seems, although you are a chef at a very famous restaurant, that seems to be part of the way you're thinking in the writing of this book.
Well, I think, everything's going too fast these days. And the kitchen is a good place to slow down, and it's a wonderful, pleasant place to be.
Are you able to maintain that in your work as a restaurant chef?
Well, in the restaurant business, things do get rather hectic. I have the good fortune to work in a restaurant where sometimes it's civilized. But even though I've cooked in restaurants for years and years, my favorite thing is still cooking at home. And I think people should be doing more of that. Everybody forgot how.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's beautiful about this book is there's a simplicity and a kind of non-intimidating set of ideas that you put out. Like in the very beginning, you're talking about being at a friend's house and trying to make something to eat, and there's nothing in the kitchen except a box of pancake mix, and you've got some jalapenos, and that's where you start.
Well, yeah, that was a little serendipitous meal that then became one of my little favorite go-to standbys for when I'm cooking for myself. The first section of the book is about cooking for one or cooking for two or sharing a little kitchen. I'm sharing some of my little private kitchen rituals, but I think everybody has kitchen rituals. The simple act of cooking breakfast for oneself can be a kind of great experience, making coffee and toast or whatever one has for breakfast. And there's something about the repetitive action of it that it's another way of looking forward to what you get to eat.
There's the simple act of peeling an apple, which you talk about.
That's one of my favorite things to do, and I'm trying in the book to give people examples of simple pleasures and seasonal pleasures as well. Because with an apple, the best thing going right now are the new crop apples. And there's nothing that tastes as good as a new crop apple. No comparison between that and one that got stored for a few months. So this is the time now to celebrate apples.
Let's talk for a moment about seasonal cooking. The book is divided into seasons. Some of the recipes are the spring, fall, winter, summer recipes. Summer, fall, that's when the great food is. What about winter? How do you get through the winter if you're really going to commit to seasonal cooking on what is truly available locally in the winter?
Well, there is great food to be had in the winter. And, I like every season of the year. Winter is a great time for root vegetables and squashes, and onions and chicories and radicchios. You may not be able to use things entirely from your local area. I think sometimes people get a little bit, the current trend for eating within your 100-mile radius is a very nice idea, but sometimes you have to get a little help from some place where it's a little bit warmer. So we can augment our good winter root vegetable staples with a little salad from California. I think it's okay.
You spend part of your time here and part of your time in Europe, and you write about having grown up in Ohio where there's virtually no local cuisine, but having discovered some really wonderful, genuinely American cuisine. What falls into good American cuisine?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, at one time in Ohio, there was regional cooking, and it was good. Ohio was all farmland 100 years ago. It's only within the last 50 years that people forgot about that. But there are still strongholds of regional cooking all over the U.S., and I know a lot of people look to, and I do as well, I get a lot of influence from the Mediterranean and from European kitchens, but I still say that regional food anywhere has merit, and there's such a lot of great American traditional cooking, gumbos, chicken and dumplings, all the wonderful fish dishes from the Northeast. And I have a special spot in my heart for New Mexico since I spent about 8 years there.
Yeah, I noticed that in your survival kit, you always have jalapenos.
I have found it necessary to travel with chilies just as a little extra insurance.
What are some examples of a place you've been in a pinch and you needed chilies?
Well, when you find yourself in an airport and forced to eat something cooked by sort of a little corporate restaurant, a few sliced jalapenos can really perk it up a little bit. On the other hand, you know, I'm big for making little impromptu picnics everywhere, so chilies come in handy all the time.
What else is in your survival kit that you carry with you?
Well, it varies a little bit. I like to have a few chiles. I like to have a little sea salt and pepper mill, a pocket knife, a corkscrew, a hunk of cheese, a few limes, those kinds of things, so that when you get to your hotel room and you don't have to avail yourself of the horrible stuff in the minibar, you've got a little something that you can subsist on for a little while, and you have some condiments for doctoring what comes your way just in case it's too bland.
Now, you live half the year in Paris, and I was wondering, you know, here we are in places like Santa Fe really talking about and trying to reinstate the farmer's market as the center of our kitchen and of our diet and doing community-supported agriculture and so on. What is it like in Paris? Are people eating, in other words, have some of those traditions been maintained? Have they had to bring them back? How do people buy and eat their food there?
Well, you know, in Europe in general, in France in particular, people still do food shopping on more or less a daily basis, because the preference is for fresh, high quality food, and everybody has a tiny refrigerator, and pretty much everybody has a small kitchen. But part of the whole process of going to the butcher and the baker and the fish man is, you know, it's an important process, you know, in the daily cultural life. And there are outdoor markets in Paris every day of the week, and those are subsidized by the government. For one thing, it keeps the feel of Paris there, but also everyone uses them. Everyone goes in their neighborhood to the open air markets to buy vegetables. I have a market in my neighborhood that's there 3 days a week, and it's a great way to sort of go down and get a lettuce, a leek, and a couple of pounds of potatoes. And you're buying them from the guy who grew them.
And so that's the other thing I was going to ask you. They are produced in a way that's more like local farming than industrial farming.
Well, industrial farming is reaching all around the world, and supermarkets are as well. And I think you'll find both ends of the spectrum in France. But I think the emphasis is more on smaller farms. Well, France is a small country. And on a more artisanal kind of farming. Yet, I mean, the whole world is going corporate. But the French are very concerned about, for instance, what Monsanto is doing to farmers around the world. So the awareness is there.
What about Italy?
I would say the same. Yes, Italy is. I love to go to markets in Italy because the Italy is so vegetable centric and so pro vegetable that it's great just to go and see enormous piles of cauliflower and radicchio in the fall, and everybody's buying.
Have you noticed, having been involved with food for such a and good food and eating food thoughtfully and seasonally and organic food and all of that, have you noticed that it's had a positive effect on your health and those of your friends and colleagues who live and eat the way that you do?
Well, I do think that the kind of food I like to cook is healthy. Mostly the food that I like is quite simple. I think the simplest food is the best. I think that I'm more I think I'm healthier than folks who are subsisting on fast food. I completely do. Yes.
What are a couple?
And I'd rather get my vitamins from vegetables than from supplements.
Right.
But I'm also in it for the sheer pleasure of cooking and eating, you know.
Well, one can tell that not only from the way the book is written and the recipes, but the photographs in it, which are just beautiful. They make you hungry just looking at them.
Aren't they good? That's my friend Christopher Hirschheimer who took the photographs. And, you know, she was one of the founding editors at Sever magazine when it first came out. And now she's actually publishing her own little journal of seasonal cookbooks under the name Canal House Cooking, which is I would recommend it. But when we went, I went to Christopher's studio in New Jersey, and we shot all the photos together. So I was able to cook all the food, and it was very immediate. Working with natural light, and it was just me in the kitchen and Christopher with the camera. So we managed, and we were. Our aim was to make it look all quite edible and quite unstyled.
Do you have a couple of favorite recipes in this book that you'd like to share?
Everybody asks me that. and that's a little bit like asking which one is my favorite kid.
Yeah, right.
But I think I'm most excited about the menus that are appropriate to the season right now. There's a wonderful braised lamb dish with Moroccan spices and prunes and almonds, which is very, very nice for this time of year. But I also have a recipe for a carne adobada because I always have to get a little something New Mexican in every cookbook. And I think it's a pretty good version of carne adobada.
Well, I'm looking at the chilled tomato soup with basil right now, and I'm hoping to go home and make some of that this week.
I hope you still have good sweet tomatoes.
Yeah, they're almost gone, but I think we've got a few left.
Good. Well, there's a heavy emphasis on vegetables in all the meals, so even people who don't prefer vegetables, I think, will find a lot of inspiration.
David Tanis is author of the new book, Heart of the Artichoke and Other Kitchen Journeys, a wonderful book, and he will be at Garcia Street Books on Tuesday, the 16th of November at 6 o'clock. Thank you very much for being with us. We look forward to seeing you.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you as well.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Edwina Milner. She's the founder of the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. She's an artist and art collector. She's been on virtually every museum board in New Mexico. She won the Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts and many other awards. And Susan Burke is here with us. She is current chairperson of the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. She's a longtime supporter of the arts, very active both on the East Coast and now here in Santa Fe. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So happy
to be
here.
And this weekend, this Saturday at La Posada here in Santa Fe, there is a tribute luncheon to honor the many decades of work of Edwina Milner. And so we wanted to invite the public to go to that and let people know about her work. How did you start off? You started off as a painter.
I did. Uh-huh. I worked my way through college as a fashion artist, doing advertisements for the paper, and just loved that, and got married right out of college and moved to a little bitty town where there was no art whatsoever, but we eventually moved to Houston, and then I got involved with the art scene in Houston and, you know, got into a gallery and got into a couple of galleries, in fact, and so painted for about 20 years until I started working I started working with the Houston Houston organization that supported artists and did things for artists, and I got on the board of that and became very enthralled with that. And actually, I went into art because I thought it would be a genderless occupation. What better place to be than art as far as women are concerned? And golly, was I surprised, because there just weren't any women accepted in the galleries. Maybe even if a woman owned the gallery in Houston, she might have one woman. And there are no women in the museums. And so that's why I got interested in working for organizations, so that I could promote women. And as I got more interested in it, I realized that I just couldn't do my own artwork and promote other women, too. So I stopped working as an artist and almost became a professional volunteer.
That is a big sacrifice to make.
It really wasn't at the time. I didn't think of about it as a sacrifice at all. It's so lonely when you're working as an artist in a studio. You're by yourself night, day, and, you know, I'd be working a long, long time, and when I had children, I'd work at night for my one-artist shows and so on. So it was fun for me when I first started because it was with working with other people, and I enjoy other people. And just about that time, the National Museum of Women in the Arts happened a few years after I started this project. So I became involved with them and was so thrilled that there was a museum that was dedicated to women artists and dedicated to doing things about. They have an auditorium in their museum in Washington, D.C., where they have all kinds of programs for authors and women authors and musicians and, you know, not just visual arts.
So when you were collecting art in all the years that you've been collecting art, you, in your own collecting, made sure to collect 50% women artists.
I did, because I think that's what the ideal should be. Right now, in museums, there are only 7% of the art that hangs in museums are by women. So that means that 93% of the art you look at are by men. And it should, you know, it should fairly be 50-50.
Well, at least in contemporary art.
At least, yes, at least. But it could have been that way in art through the ages, because there, even though women were forbidden to go to art school until the 1900s, women were still artists because they were they learned from their father or their brother or their uncle or something, and there have been famous artists all through the years, and that's the good thing about the National Museum of Women in the Art, that they have done the research about these women from the 1200s, from the 1400s, and so on. In fact, the reason that museum is in existence is that Wilhelmina Holliday, who's the founder, and her husband went on a buying trip to Europe and found a wonderful painting by Clara Peters. And it was painted about 1612. And they came back to the United States and did some research about her. Could not find her in any art history book. In fact, they couldn't find any women in art history books. And so that's when they decided to start a collection of women artists. And through that, then it grew and grew. And then they found a fabulous building in Washington, D.C., and converted it into the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
Now, how did you come to found the New Mexico Committee?
Well, I was on the Texas Committee for about 11 years. They have, it's a wonderful system that Wilhelmina and her staff started quite early in the history of the museum of having state committees. So I was on the Texas committee, and then when I moved to New Mexico, well, God, I was inspired because there's so many artists here, and there was no committee. So I invited the Texas committee over right at first and did a great tour for them in New Mexico and so on. And after that, I got organized and got some women together to promote New Mexico. And that is in our bylaws, that we not only support the National Museum in Washington, but our emphasis is on doing things for living New Mexico women artists. So we've had multiple jewelry shows that have been exhibited in the various museums around the state. And we've also promoted women who are designers and and jewelers and so on. We've had all-day events for them where they could show their creations and sell them and so on. And we also work with education also, doing educational programs, how to teach them better business as far as an artist. And recently, Susan can talk about this, we hooked up with the Girls Club of Santa Fe.
Girls Inc. of Santa Fe. We provided an art teacher 2 summers in a row, 7 to 8 weeks, to teach the girls art. And this deals with art leadership, personal self-esteem, and self-expression. And it's been a very successful program.
So you are the current chairperson of the New Mexico Committee, Susan, of the National Museum of Women in the Arts, following in Edwina's footsteps.
Absolutely following in her footsteps. She's been an inspiration. She's a real supporter to women. I call Edwina the grand dame of the arts here. It's a term. Her curiosity is never ending. Her spirit and enthusiasm. And she's always handles things with grace and intelligence. And being an artist, she has that creative spirit. And she's a artistic entrepreneur, too, because she knows how to grow things. Edwina has a virtual garden of art and talent. And she actually does gardening at her home and has one of the most spectacular gardens in Santa Fe. And her use of color and sensibility of how to bring people in and allow people their own creativity.
One of the things that I've been so inspired by here in New Mexico, and particularly with the work of the Santa Fe Art Institute, is learning the extent to which artists as a group are entrepreneurs, are problem solvers, are people who work well in groups, are basically part of the fabric of society without whom, I mean, it's not decoration. It's the part of the essential lifeblood of a community, that creativity and the spirit and intelligence that artists bring to community.
It's phenomenal, and it's terribly important in New Mexico. There's a study that the Cultural Arts Division did just this year that says that $3.3 billion is brought into the state of New Mexico from our art. And
that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And $245 million are at tax, cover our taxes from our, bring it in from art.
Right.
So it's tremendously.
So that covers the services that we use every day.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I look at it as a fabric that the artists are weaving, a tapestry right before our eyes. I mean, the public art throughout Santa Fe is evident, and sculpturing, the colors, the textures. I mean, all the galleries here, many of them are women-owned galleries. I'd say predominantly women-owned art galleries here, as well as our museum directors. At least 4 or 5 of our museums are headed by women directors. So
with PhDs, they're very educated.
Now, have you been able to, I mean, after all these decades of supporting the arts, to get back to your own artwork?
I have, and it's just so much fun. About 3 years ago, I started resigning from a bunch of the museum boards and things like that so that I'll have more time, and I'm, you know, not in competition now. And, of course, I wouldn't enter anything that is sponsored by the New Mexico Committee, but I could enter other things and that kind of thing.
We're going to have a chance to see Edwina's art at the luncheon. We're going to be in the ballroom, and on the walls of the ballroom will be Edwina's most recent works.
The luncheon is at the La Posada Ballroom. It's this Saturday at noon, November 13th. The public is invited. People can call the Lenzik box office if they would like tickets. The number there is 988-1234. It's sponsored by the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. And we've been talking to Edwina Milner and Susan Burke. I want to thank you so much for being here and all that both of you have done and are doing for our city.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.